However, David had responded heartily to the teaching machines, had in fact scored very high. The boy liked most of his teachers and came home raving about them. He got along fine with even the most severe of them, and by now it was obvious that he had no problems. He was not autistic, and he would never see the inside of Camp BG. But this had not made Jack feel better. Nothing, Sylvia had pointed out, would make him feel better. Only the two possibilities lay open, the public school and Camp BG, and Jack distrusted both. And why was that? He did not know. Perhaps, he had once conjectured, it was because there really was such a condition as autism. It was a childhood form of schizophrenia, which a lot of people had. Schizophrenia was a major illness which touched sooner or later almost every family. It meant simply a person who could not live out the drives implanted in him by his society. The reality which the schizophrenic fell away from, or never incorporated in the first place, was the reality of interpersonal living, of life in a given culture with given values. It was not biological life or any form of inherited life, but life which was learned. It had to be picked up bit by bit from those around one, parents and teachers, authority figures in general, from everyone a person came in contact with during his formative years. The public school, then, was right to eject a child who did not learn, because what the child was learning was not merely facts or the basis of a money-making or even useful career. It went much deeper. The child learned that certain things in the culture around him were worth preserving at any cost. His values were fused with some objective human enterprise, and so he himself became a part of the tradition handed down to him. He maintained his heritage during his lifetime and even improved on it. He cared. True autism, Jack had decided, was in the last analysis an apathy toward public endeavor. It was a private existence carried on as if the individual person were the creator of all value, rather than merely the repository of inherited values. And Jack Bolin, for the life of him, could not accept the public school with its teaching machines as the sole arbiter of what was and what wasn't of value. For the values of a society were in ceaseless flux, and the public school was an attempt to stabilize those values, to gel them at a fixed point, to embalm them. The public school, he had long ago decided, was neurotic. It wanted a world in which nothing new came about, in which there were no surprises. And that was the world of the compulsive obsessive neurotic. It was not a healthy world at all. Once, a couple of years ago, he had told his wife his theory. Sylvia had listened with a reasonable amount of attention, and then she had said, "But you don't see the point, Jack. Try to understand. There are things so much worse than neurosis." Her voice had been low and firm, and he had listened. "We're just beginning to find them out. You know what they are. You've gone through them." And he had nodded, because he did know what she meant. He himself had had a psychotic interlude in his early 20s. It was common. It was natural. And, he had to admit, it was horrible. It made the fixed, rigid, compulsive, neurotic public school seem a reference point by which one could gratefully steer one's course back to mankind and shared reality. It made him comprehend why a neurosis was a deliberate artifact, deliberately constructed by the ailing individual or by a society in crisis. It was an invention arising from necessity. "Don't knock neurosis," Sylvia had said to him, and he understood. Neurosis was a deliberate stopping, a freezing somewhere along the path of life, because beyond lay... Every schizophrenic knew what lay there, and every ex-schizophrenic, Jack thought, as he remembered his own episode. The two men across the room from him gazed at him queerly. What had he said? Herbert Hoover was a much better head of the FBI than Carrington will ever be? "I know I'm right," he added. "I'll lay you odds." His mind seemed fuzzy, and he sipped at his beer. Everything had become heavy, his arm and the glass itself. It was easier to look down rather than up. He studied the match folder on the coffee table. "You don't mean Herbert Hoover," Lou Notting said. "You mean J. Edgar." "Christ," Jack thought in dismay. Yes, he had said Herbert Hoover, and until they had pointed it out, it seemed okay. "What's the matter with me?" he wondered. "I feel like I'm half asleep." And yet he had gone to bed at 10 the night before, had slept almost 12 hours. "Excuse me," he said. "Of course, I mean..." He felt his tongue stumble. With care, he said, "J. Edgar Hoover." but his voice sounded blurred and slowed down like a turntable losing its momentum. And now it was almost impossible for him to raise his head. He was falling asleep where he sat, there in Notting's living room, and yet his eyes weren't closing. He found when he tried that he couldn't close them. His attention had become riveted on the match folder. "Close cover before striking," he read. "Can you draw this horse? First art lesson free, no obligation. Turn over for free enrollment blank." Unblinking, he stared on and on while Lou Notting and Fred Clark argued about abstract ideas such as the curtailment of liberties, the democratic process. He heard all the words perfectly clearly, and he did not mind listening, but he felt no desire to argue, even though he knew they both were wrong. He let them argue on. It was easier. It simply happened, and he let it happen. "Jack's not with us tonight," Clark was saying. With a start, Jack Boland realized they had turned their attention on him. He had to do or say something now. "Sure I am," he said, and it cost him terrific effort. It was like rising up out of the sea. "Go on, I'm listening." "God, you're like a dummy," Notting said. "Go home and go to bed, for Christ's sakes." Entering the living room, Lou's wife Phyllis said, "You'll never get to Mars in the state you're in now, Jack." She turned up the hi-fi. It was a progressive jazz group, vibes and double bass, or perhaps it was an electronic instrument playing. Blonde, pert Phyllis seated herself on the couch near him and studied him. "Jack, are you sore at us? I mean, you're so withdrawn." "It's just one of his moods," Notting said. "When we were in the service, he used to get them, especially on Saturday night. Morose and silent, brooding. What are you brooding about right now, Jack?" The question seemed odd to him. He was not brooding about anything. His mind was empty. The match folder still filled up his range of perception. Nevertheless, it was necessary that he give them an account of what he was brooding over. They all expected it, so dutifully he made up a topic. "The air," he said. "On Mars. How long will it take me to adjust?" "Varies among different people." A yawn, which never came out, had lodged in his chest, diffusing throughout his lungs and windpipe. It left his mouth hanging partly open. With an effort, he managed to close his jaws. "Guess I better go on," he said. "Hit the sack." With the use of all his strength, he managed to get to his feet. "At 9 o'clock?" Fred Clark yelled. Later, as he walked home to his apartment along the cool, dark streets of Oakland, he felt fine. He wondered what had been wrong back there at Notting's. Maybe bad air or the ventilation. But something was wrong. Mars, he thought. He had cut the ties, in particular his job, had sold his Plymouth, given notice to the official who was his landlord, and it had taken him a year to get the apartment. The building was owned by the nonprofit West Coast Co-op, an enormous structure partly underground with thousands of units, its own supermarket, laundries, child care center, clinic, even its own psychiatrist, down below in the arcade of shops beneath the street level. There was an FM radio station on the top floor which broadcast classical music chosen by the building residents, and in the center of the building could be found a theater and meeting hall. This was the newest of the huge cooperative apartment buildings, and he had given it all up suddenly. One day he had been in the building's bookstore waiting in line to buy a book, and the idea came to him. After he had given notice, he had wandered along the corridors of the co-op arcade. When he came to the bulletin board with its stacked-up notices, he had halted automatically to read them. Children scampered past him on their way to the playground behind the building. One notice, large and printed, attracted his attention. "Help spread the co-op movement to newly colonized areas. Emigration prepared by the co-op board in Sacramento in answer to big business and big labor union exploitation of mineral-rich areas of Mars. Sign up now." It read much like all the co-op notices, and yet, why not? A lot of young people were going. And what was left for him on Earth? He had given up his co-op apartment, but he was still a member. He still had his share of stock and his number. Later on, when he had signed up and was in the process of being given his physical and his shots, the sequence had blurred in his mind. He remembered the decision to go to Mars as coming first, and then the giving up of his job and apartment. It seemed more rational that way, and he told that story to his friends. But it simply wasn't true. What was true? For almost 2 months he had wandered about, confused and despairing, not certain of anything except that on November 14th his group, 200 co-op members would leave for Mars, and then everything would be changed. The confusion would lift, and he would see clearly, as he had once at some vague period in the past. He knew that. Once he had been able to establish the order of things in space and time. Now, for reasons unknown to him, both space and time had shifted so that he could not find his bearings in either one. His life had no purpose. For 14 months he had lived with one massive goal, to acquire an apartment in the huge new co-op building. And then, when he had gotten it, there was nothing. The future had ceased to exist. He listened to the box sweets which he requested. He bought food at the supermarket and browsed in the building bookstore. But what for? He asked himself. Who am I? And at his job, his ability faded away. That was the first indication, and in some ways the most ominous of all. That was what had first frightened him. It began with a weird incident which he was never able to fully account for. Apparently, part of it had been pure hallucination. But which part? It had been dreamlike, and he had had a moment of overwhelming panic, the desire to run, to get out at any cost. His job was with an electronics firm in Redwood City, south of San Francisco. He operated a machine which maintained quality control along the assembly line. It was his responsibility to see that his machine did not deviate from its concept of acceptable tolerances in a single component. A liquid helium battery no larger than a match head. One day he was summoned to the personnel manager's office, unexpectedly. He did not know why they wanted him, and as he took the elevator up he was quite nervous. Later he remembered that. He was unusually nervous. "Come in, Mr. Bolin." The personnel manager, a fine-looking man with curly gray hair, perhaps a fashion wig, welcomed him into his office. "This won't take but a moment." He eyed Jack keenly. "Mr. Bolin, why aren't you cashing your paychecks?" There was silence. "Aren't I?" Jack said. His heart thudded ponderously, making his body shake. He felt unsteady and tired. "I thought I was," he said to himself. "You could stand a new suit," the personnel manager said. "And you need a haircut. Of course it's your business." Putting his hand to his scalp, Jack felt about, puzzled. Did he need a haircut? Hadn't he just had one last week? Or maybe it was longer ago than that. He said, "Thanks." He nodded. "Okay, I will. What you just said." And then the hallucination, if it was that, happened. He saw the personnel manager in a new light. The man was dead. He saw, through the man's skin, his skeleton. It had been wired together, the bones connected with fine copper wire. The organs, which had withered away, were replaced by artificial components, kidney, heart, lungs. Everything was made of plastic and stainless steel, all working in unison but entirely without authentic life. The man's voice issued from a tape through an amplifier and speaker system. Possibly at some time in the past the man had been real and alive, but that was over, and the stealthy replacement had taken place, inch by inch, progressing insidiously from one organ to the next, and the entire structure was there to deceive others. To deceive him, Jack Bolin, in fact. He was alone in this office. There was no personnel manager. No one spoke to him, and when he himself talked, no one heard. It was entirely a lifeless, mechanical room in which he stood. He was not sure what to do. He tried not to stare too hard at the man-like structure before him. He tried to talk calmly, naturally, about his job and even his personal problems. The structure was probing. It wanted to learn something from him. Naturally, he told it as little as possible. And all the time, as he gazed down at the carpet, he saw its pipes and valves and working parts functioning away. He could not keep from seeing. All he wanted to do was get away as soon as possible. He began to sweat. He was dripping with sweat and trembling, and his heart pounded louder and louder. "Bolin," the structure said, "are you sick?" "Yes," he said. "Can I go back down to my bench now?" He turned and started toward the door. "Just a moment," the structure said from behind him. That was when panic overtook him, and he ran. He pulled the door open and ran out into the hall. An hour or so later, he found himself wandering along an unfamiliar street in Burlingame. He did not remember the intervening time, and he did not know how he had gotten where he was. His legs ached. Evidently, he had walked, mile after mile. His head was much clearer. "I'm schizophrenic," he said to himself. "I know it." Everyone knows the symptoms. It's catatonic excitement with paranoid coloring. The mental health people drill it into us, even into the school kids. I'm another one of those. That was what the personnel manager was probing. I need medical help. As Jack removed the power supply of the angry janitor and laid it on the floor, the master circuit of the school said, "You are very skillful." Jack glanced up at the middle-aged female figure and thought to himself, "It's obvious why this place unnerves me. It's like my psychotic experience of years ago. Did I, at that time, look into the future?" There had been no schools of this kind then, or if there had, he had not seen them or known about them. "Thank you," he said. What had tormented him ever since the psychotic episode with the personnel manager at Corona Corporation was this. Suppose it was not a hallucination. Suppose the so-called personnel manager was as he had seen him, an artificial construct, a machine like these teaching machines. If that had been the case, then there was no psychosis. Instead of a psychosis, he had thought again and again, it was more on the order of a vision, a glimpse of absolute reality with the facade stripped away. And it was so crushing, so radical an idea that it could not be meshed with his ordinary views, and the mental disturbance had come out of that. Reaching into the exposed wiring of the angry janitor, Jack felt expertly with his long fingers until at last he touched what he knew to be there, a broken lead. "I think I've got hold of it," he said to the master circuit of the school. Thank God, he thought, these aren't the old-fashioned printed circuits. Were that the case, he would have to replace the unit. Repair would be impossible. "My understanding," the master circuit said, "is that much effort went into the designing of the teachers' re-problems of repair. We have been fortunate so far. No prolonged interruption of service has taken place. However, I believe that preventive maintenance is indicated wherever possible. Therefore, I would like you to inspect one additional teacher, which has as yet shown no signs of a breakdown. It is uniquely vital to the total functioning of the school." The master circuit paused politely as Jack struggled to get the long tip of the soldering iron past the layers of wire. "It is Kindly Dad which I want you to inspect." Jack said, "Kindly Dad." And he thought acidly, "I wonder if there's an Aunt Mom in here somewhere. Aunt Mom's delicious home-baked tall tales for little tots to imbibe." He felt nauseated. "You are familiar with that teacher?" As a matter of fact, he was not. David hadn't mentioned it. From farther down the corridor, he could hear the children still discussing life with the Whitlock. Their voices reached him as he lay on his back, holding the soldering gun above his head and reaching into the works of the angry janitor to keep the tip in place. "Yes," the Whitlock was saying in its never-ruffled, absolutely placid voice. "The raccoon is an amazing fellow, old Jimmy Raccoon is. Many times I've seen him, and he's quite a large fellow, by the way, with powerful long arms, which are really quite agile." "I saw a raccoon once," a child piped excitedly. "Mr. Whitlock, I saw one, and he was this close to me." Jack thought, "You saw a raccoon on Mars?" The Whitlock chuckled. "No, Don, I'm afraid not. There aren't any raccoons around here. You'd have to go all the way across over to old Mother Earth to see one of those amazing fellas. But the point I'd like to make is this, boys and girls. You know how old Jimmy Raccoon takes his food and carries it oh so stealthily to the water and washes it? And how we laughed at old Jimmy when the lump of sugar dissolved and he had nothing at all left to eat? Well, boys and girls, do you know that we've got Jimmy Raccoons right here in this very—" "I think I'm finished," Jack said, withdrawing the gun. "Do you want to help me put this back together?" The master circuit said, "Are you in a rush?" "I don't like that thing talking away in there," Jack said. It made him tense and shaky, so much so that he could hardly do his work. A door rolled shut down the corridor from them. The sound of the Whitlock's voice ceased. "Is that better?" the master circuit asked. "Thanks," Jack said. But his hands were still shaking. The master circuit noted that. He was aware of her precise scrutiny. He wondered what she made of it. The chamber in which Kindly Dad sat consisted of one end of a living room with fireplace, couch, coffee table, curtained picture window, and an easy chair in which Kindly Dad himself sat, a newspaper open on his lap. Several children sat attentively on the couch as Jack Bolin and the master circuit entered. They were listening to the expostulations of the teaching machine and did not seem aware that anyone had come in. The Master Circuit dismissed the children, and then she started to leave, too. "I'm not sure what you want me to do," Jack said. "Put it through its cycle. It seems to me that it repeats portions of the cycle or stays stuck. In any case, too much time is consumed. It should return to its starting stage in about 3 hours." A door opened for the Master Circuit, and she was gone. He was alone with Kindly Dad, and he was not glad of it. "Hi, Kindly Dad," he said without enthusiasm. Setting down his tool case, he began unscrewing the back plate of the teacher. Kindly Dad said in a warm, sympathetic voice, "What's your name, young fellow?" "My name," Jack said as he unfastened the plate and laid it down beside him, "is Jack Bolin, and I'm a Kindly Dad, too, just like you, Kindly Dad. My boy is 10 years old, Kindly Dad, so don't call me a young fellow, okay?" Again he was trembling hard and sweating. "Oh," Kindly Dad said, "I see." "What do you see?" Jack said, and discovered that he was almost shouting. "Look," he said, "go through your goddamn cycle, okay? If it makes it easier for you, go ahead and pretend I'm a little boy." "I just want to get this done and get out of here," he said to himself, with as little trouble as possible. He could feel the swelling, complicated emotions inside him. 3 hours, he thought dismally. Kindly Dad said, "Little Jackie, it seems to me you've got a mighty heavy weight on your chest today, am I right?" "Today and every day." Jack clicked on his trouble light and shone it up into the works of the teacher. The mechanism seemed to be moving along its cycle properly so far. "Maybe I can help you," Kindly Dad said. "Often it helps if an older, more experienced person can sort of listen in on your troubles, can sort of share them and make them lighter." "Okay," Jack agreed, sitting back on his haunches. "I'll play along. I'm stuck here for 3 hours anyhow." "You want me to go all the way back to the beginning, to the episode back on Earth when I worked for Corona Corporation and had the occlusion?"
"Start wherever you like," Kindly Dad said graciously.
"Do you know what schizophrenia is, Kindly Dad?"
"I believe I've got a pretty good idea, Jackie," Kindly Dad said.
"Well, Kindly Dad, it's the most mysterious malady in all medicine, that's what it is, and it shows up in 1 out of every 6 people, which is a lot of people."
"Yes, that certainly is," Kindly Dad said.
"At one time," Jack said as he watched the machinery moving, "I had what they call situational polymorphous schizophrenia simplex. And Kindly Dad, it was rough."
"I just bet it was," Kindly Dad said.
"Now, I know what you're supposed to be for," Jack said. "I know your purpose, Kindly Dad. We're a long way from home, millions of miles away. Our connection with our civilization back home is tenuous, and a lot of folks are mighty scared, Kindly Dad, because with each passing year that link gets weaker. So this public school was set up to present a fixed milieu to the children born here, an Earth-like environment. For instance, this fireplace. We don't have fireplaces here on Mars. We heat by small atomic furnaces. That picture window with all that glass. Sandstorms would make it opaque. In fact, there's not one thing about you that's derived from our actual world here. Do you know what a bleakman is, Kindly Dad?"
"Can't say that I do, little Jackie. What is a bleakman?"
"It's one of the indigenous races of Mars. You know you're on Mars, don't you?" Kindly Dad nodded. "Schizophrenia," Jack said, "is one of the most pressing problems human civilization has ever faced. Frankly, Kindly Dad, I emigrated to Mars because of my schizophrenic episode when I was 22 and worked for Corona Corporation. I was cracking up. I had to move out of a complex urban environment into a simpler one, a primitive frontier environment with more freedom. The pressure was too great for me. It was emigrate or go mad. That co-op building, can you imagine a thing going down level after level and up like a skyscraper, with enough people living there for them to have their own supermarket? I went mad standing in line at the bookstore. Everybody else, Kindly Dad, every single person in that bookstore and in that supermarket, all of them lived in the same building I did. It was a society, Kindly Dad, that one building, and today it's small by comparison with some that have been built. What do you say to that?"
"My, my," Kindly Dad said, shaking his head.
"Now here's what I think," Jack said. "I think this public school and you teaching machines are going to rear another generation of schizophrenics, the descendants of people like me who are making a fine adaptation to this new planet. You're going to split the psyches of these children because you're teaching them to expect an environment which doesn't exist for them. It doesn't even exist back on Earth now. It's obsolete. Ask that Whitlock teacher if intelligence doesn't have to be practical to be true intelligence. I heard it say so. It has to be a tool for adaptation. Right, Kindly Dad?"
"Yes, little Jackie, it has to be." "'What you ought to be teaching,' Jack said, "'is how do we—'
"'Yes, little Jackie?' kindly Dad interrupted him. "'It has to be.'
And as it said this, a gear tooth slipped in the glare of Jack's trouble light, and a phase of the cycle repeated itself. "'You're stuck,' Jack said. "'Kindly, Dad, you've got a worn gear tooth.'
"'Yes, little Jackie,' kindly Dad said. "'It has to be.'
"'You're right,' Jack said. "'It does have to be. Everything wears out eventually. Nothing is permanent. Change is the one constant of life, right, kindly Dad?'
"'Yes, little Jackie,' kindly Dad said. It has to be.
Shutting off the teaching machine at its power supply, Jack began to disassemble its main shaft, preparatory to removing the worn gear. So you found it, the master circuit said, when Jack emerged a half hour later, wiping his face with his sleeve. Yes, he said. He was exhausted. His wristwatch told him that it was only 4 o'clock. An hour more of work lay ahead of him. The master circuit accompanied him to the parking lot. "'I'm quite pleased with the promptness with which you attended to our needs,' she said. "'I will telephone Mr. Yi and thank him.' He nodded and climbed into his copter, too worn out even to say goodbye. Soon he was ascending. The duck egg, which was the UN-operated public school, became small and far away below him. Its stifling presence vanished, and he could breathe again. Flipping on his transmitter, he said, "'Mr. Yi, this is Jack. I'm done at the school. What next?' After a pause, Mr. Yee's pragmatic voice answered, "'Jack, Mr. Arnie Cott at Lewistown called us. He requested that we service an encoding dictation machine in which he places great trust. Since all others of our crew are tied up, I am sending you.'" Chapter 6 Arnie Cott owned the only harpsichord on Mars. However, it was out of tune, and he could find no one to service it. No matter which way you cut it, there were no harpsichord tuners on Mars. For a month now, he had been training his tame Bleakman to tackle this task. Bleakman had a fine ear for music, and his particular one seemed to understand what Arnie wanted. Heliogabalus had been provided with a translation into the Bleaky dialect of a manual on keyboard instrument maintenance, and Arnie expected results any day now. But meanwhile, the harpsichord was virtually unplayable. Back in Lewistown, from his visit to Anne Esterhazy, Arnie Cott felt glum. The death of the black market goodies man, Norbert Steiner, was a solid blow below the belt, and Arnie knew that he would have to make a move, probably a drastic and unprecedented one, to compensate for it. It was now 3 o'clock in the afternoon. What had he gotten out of his trip to New Israel? Only a piece of bad news. Anne, as usual, could not be talked into anything. She intended to go right on with her amateurish campaigns and causes, and if she were the laughing stock of Mars, it did not matter to her. "'God damn you, Heliogabalus!' Arnie said with fury. "'You get that goddamn instrument playing right, or I'm kicking you out of Lewistown. You can go back to eating beetles and roots in the desert with the rest of your kind.' Seated on the floor beside the harpsichord, the Bleakman winced, glanced up acutely at Arnie Cott, then lowered his eyes to the manual once more. "'Nothing ever gets fixed around here,' Arnie grumbled. All Mars, he decided, was a sort of Humpty Dumpty. The original state had been one of perfection, and they and their property had all fallen from that state into rusty bits and useless debris. He felt sometimes as if he presided over an enormous junkyard. And then, once more, he thought about the Yi Company repair copter which he had run into in the desert, and the Zwep piloting it. Independent bastards, Arnie said to himself, ought to be taken down a peg or two. But they knew their worth. Vital to the economy of the planet, it was written on their faces. We bow to no man, etc. Arnie paced about the big front room of the Lewistown house, which he maintained in addition to his apartment at Union Hall, hands in his pockets, scowling. Imagine, that guy talked back to me just like that, Arnie reflected. He must be a hell of a good repairman to be so confident. And Arnie also thought, I'm going to get that guy if it's the last thing I do. Nobody talks to me like that and gets away with it. But of the two thoughts about the Yi Company uppity repairman, the former slowly began to dominate his mind, because he was a practical man and knew that things had to be kept running. Codes of conduct had to come second. We're not running a medieval society here, Arnie said to himself. If the guy's really good, he can say what he wants to me. All I care about is results. With that in mind, he telephoned the Yi Company at Bunchwood Park, and soon had Mr. Yi himself on the line. Listen, Arnie said. I got a sick encoder over here, and if you fellows can get it working, maybe I can use you on a permanent contract basis. You follow me?" There was no doubt of it. Mr. Yi followed him all right. He saw the entire picture.
"Our best man, sir, right away. And I know we'll give absolute satisfaction any hour of the day or night."
"I want one particular man," Arnie said, and he thereupon described the repairman he had met in the desert.
"Young, dark-haired, slender," Mr. Yi repeated. "Glasses and with a nervous manner. That would be Mr. Jack Bolin, our finest."
"Let me tell you," Arnie said, "that this guy Bolin talked to me in a way I don't let nobody talk to me. But after I thought it over, I realized he was in the right, and when I see him, I'm going to tell him that to his face." However, in actuality, Arnicott no longer could recall what the issue had been. "That guy Bolin seems to have a good head on him," he wound up. "Can he get over here today?" Without hesitation, Mr. Yi promised service by 5 o'clock. "I appreciate that," Arnie said. "And be sure and tell him that Arnie holds no grudges. Sure, I was taken aback at the time, but that's all over. Tell him," he pondered. "Tell Bolin he's got absolutely nothing to worry about regarding me." He rang off then and sat back with a feeling of grim, honest accomplishment. So the day, after all, wasn't a total waste. And, too, he had gotten an interesting bit of information from Anne while over at New Israel. He had brought up the topic of the rumored goings-on in the FDR Mountains, and as usual Anne knew a few inside yarns emanating from home, accounts no doubt garbled in the chain of oral tellings. Yet the nugget of veracity was there. The UN back home was in the process of staging one of its periodic coups. It was going to descend on the FDR Mountains in another couple of weeks and lay claim to them as public domain land belonging to no one. Which was palpably true. But why was it that the UN wanted a big hunk of worthless real estate? There, Anne's tale got perplexing. One story noised about back at Geneva was that the UN intended to build an enormous supranational park, a sort of Garden of Eden, to lure emigrants out of Earth. Another had it that the UN engineers were going to make a vast final attack on the problem of beefing up the power sources on Mars. They were going to set up a huge hydrogen atomic energy power plant, unique in both size and scope. The water system would be revitalized, and with adequate sources of power, heavy industry could at last move over to Mars, taking advantage of free land, light gravity, low taxation. And then another rumor had it that the UN was going to set up a military base in the FDR Mountains to offset United States and Soviet plans along the same general lines. Whichever rumor was true, one fact stuck out. Certain parcels of land in the FDR range were going to be acutely valuable pretty soon. The entire range was up for sale right now, in pieces varying from 0.5 acre to 100,000 acres, and at a staggeringly low price. Once speculators got wind of the UN's plans, this would change. No doubt the speculators were already beginning to act. To claim land on Mars, they had to be on the spot. It could not be done from home. That was the law. So one could expect the speculators to start coming over any time now, if Anne's rumors were correct. It would be like the first year of colonization when speculators were active everywhere. Seating himself at his out-of-tune harpsichord, Arnie opened a book of Scarlatti sonatas and began to bang away at one of his favorites, a cross-hand one on which he had been practicing for months. It was strong, rhythmic, vigorous music, and he pounded the keys with delight, ignoring the distorted sound itself. Heliogabalus moved further off to study his manual. The sound hurt his ears. "I've got a long playing record of this," he said to Heliogabalus as he played. "So goddamn old and valuable that I don't dare play it."
"What is a long playing record?" the bleak man asked.
"You wouldn't understand if I told you. Glenn Gould playing. It's 40 years old. My family passed it down to me. It was my mother's. That guy could really hammer these cross-hand sonatas out." His own playing discouraged him, and he gave up. "I could never be any good," he decided, "even if this instrument were in peak condition like it was before I had it shipped here from home." Seated on the bench but not playing, Arnie ruminated once more on the golden opportunities involved in the FDR Mountains land. "I could buy in any time," he thought, "with union funds. But where? It's a big range. I can't buy at all." "Who knows that range?" he asked himself. "That Steiner probably did, because as I understand it, his base of operations is, or rather was, someplace near there. And there are prospectors coming and going, and Bleakman lived there too." "Helio," he said, "do you know the FDR range?"
Mister, I do know them, the bleak man said. I shun them. They are cold and empty and have no life.
Is it true, Arnie said, that you bleak men have an oracular rock that you go to when you want to know the future?
Yes, mister. The uncivilized bleak men have that. But it is vain superstition.
Dirty Nobby, the rock is called. You never consulted yourself?
No, mister.
Could you find that rock if necessary?
Yes, mister.
I'll give you a dollar, Arnie said, if you take a question to your goddamn Dirty Nobby rock for me.
Thank you, mister, but I cannot do it.
Why not, Helio?
It would proclaim my ignorance to consult with such fraudulency.
Christ, Arnie said, disgusted. Just as a game, can't you do that for a joke? The bleak man said nothing, but his dark face was tight with resentment. He pretended to resume his reading of the manual.
You fellows were stupid to give up your native religion, Arnie said. You showed how weak you are. I wouldn't have. Tell me how to find Dirty Nobby and I'll ask it myself. I know goddamn well that your religion teaches that you can foretell the future. And what's so peculiar about that? We've got extrasensory individuals back home, and some of them have precognition, can read the future. Of course, we have to lock them up with the other nuts, because that's a symptom of schizophrenia, if you happen to know what that means.
Yes, mister, Heliogabalus said. I know schizophrenia. It is the savage within the man.
Sure, it's the reversion to primitive ways of thought. But so what if you can read the future? In those mental health camps back home, there must be hundreds of precogs. And then a thought struck Arnie Cott. Maybe there are a couple here on Mars at Camp BG. The hell with Dirty Nobby Rock, then, Arnie thought. I'll drop by BG one day before they close it and get me a precog nut. I'll bail him out of the camp and put him on the payroll right here in Lewistown. Going to his telephone, he called the union steward, Edward L. Goggins. Eddie, he said when he had hold of the steward, you trot over to our psychiatric clinic and collar those doctors, and you bring back a description of what a precog nut is like, I mean, what symptoms, and if they know one at Camp BG, we could nab.
Okay, Arnie, will do.
Who's the best psychiatrist on Mars, Eddie?
Oh, gosh, Arnie, I'd have to check into it. The truckers have a good one, Milton Glaub.
Reason I know that is my wife's brother is a trucker and got analysis from Glaub last year, plus naturally effective representation. I suppose this Glaub knows BG pretty good?
Oh, yeah, Arnie, he's over there once a week. They all take turns. The Jews pay pretty good. They've got so much dough to spend. They get the dough from Israel back on Earth, you know.
Well, get hold of this Glaub and tell him to rustle up a precog schizophrenic for me as soon as possible. Put Glaub on the payroll, but only if you have to. Most of those psychiatrists are aching for regular money. They see so little of it. Understand, Eddie?
Right, Arnie.
The steward rang off.
You ever been psychoanalyzed, Helio? Arnie said to him, feeling cheerful now.
No, mister. Entire psychoanalysis is a vain, glorious foolishness.
How's that, Helio?
Question they never deal with is, what do remote sick person like? There is no what, mister.
I don't get you, Helio.
Purpose of life is unknown, and hence way to be is hidden from the eyes of living critters. Who can say if perhaps the schizophrenics are not correct? Mister, they take a brave journey. They turn away from mere things, which one may handle and turn to practical use. They turn inward to meaning. There the black night without bottom lies, the pit. Who can say if they will return? And if so, what will they be like, having glimpsed meaning? I admire them.
Christ, Arnie said with derision. You half-educated freak. I'll bet if human civilization disappeared from Mars, you'd be right back there among those savages in 10 seconds flat, worshipping idols and all the rest of it. Why do you pretend you want to be like us? Why are you reading that manual?
Heliogabalus said,
human civilization will never leave Mars, mister. That is why I study this book.
Out of that book, Arnie said, you better be able to tune up my goddamn harpsichord, or you will be back in the desert, whether human civilization stays on Mars or not.
Yes, sir, his tame bleakman said.
Ever since he had lost his union card and could not then legally perform his job, Otto Zitti's life had been a continual mess. With a card, he would be by now a first-class repairman. It was his secret that he had once held such a card and had managed to lose it. Even his employer, Norb Steiner, did not know it. For reasons he himself did not understand, Otto preferred others to believe he had simply failed the aptitude tests. Perhaps it was easier to think of himself as a failure. After all, the repair business was almost impossible to get into, and after having gotten into it, to be booted out. It was his own fault. There he had been, 3 years ago, a paid-up member of the union in good standing, in other words, a bona fide good member. The future was wide open for him. He was young, he had a girlfriend and his own copter, the latter leased, the former, although he had not known it at the time, shared. And what could hold him back? What, except possibly his own stupidity? He had broken a union ruling which was a basic law. In his opinion, it was a foolish ruling, but nonetheless. Vengeance is mine, saith the extraterrestrial repairman's union, Martian Branch. Wow, how he hated the bastards. His hatred had warped his life, and he recognized that. And he did nothing about it. He wanted it to warp him. He wanted to keep on hating them, the vast monolithic structure, wherever it existed. They had caught him for giving socialized repair. And the hell of it was that it wasn't actually socialized because he expected to get back a profit. It was just a new way of charging his customers, and in a sense not so new anyhow. It was actually the oldest way in the world, a barter system. But his revenue could not be divvied up so that the union got its cut. His trade had been with certain housewives living out in remote tracts, very lonely women whose husbands stayed in the city 5 days a week, coming home only on weekends. Otto, who was good-looking, slender, with long, combed-back black hair, in his account of himself, anyhow, had made time with one woman after another, and an outraged husband, on finding out, had, instead of shooting Otto to death, gone instead to the union hiring hall and lodged a formal charge. Repairs without compensation at scale. Well, it certainly was not scale, he admitted that. And so now this job with Norb Steiner, which meant that he had practically to live in the wastelands of the FDR Mountains, alienated from society for weeks on end, growing more and more lonely, more embittered all the time. It had been his need for intimate personal contact that had gotten him into trouble in the first place, and now look at him. As he sat in the storage shed waiting for the next rocket to show up, he looked back on his life and reflected that even the Bleakman wouldn't be willing or able to live as he lived, cut off from everyone like this. If only his own black market operations had succeeded. He, like Norb Steiner, had been able to swing around the planet daily, visiting one person after another. Was it his fault that the items he chose to import were hot enough to interest the big boys? His judgment had been too good. His line had sold too well. He hated the big racketeers, too, same as he hated the big unions.